Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. While all our focus has been on the COVID-19 public health emergency, there's another public health crisis, which was a major focus prior to the coronavirus outbreak, which is continuing in the background. The battle against opioid addiction and overdose deaths has been an ongoing problem in the United States for the past 20 years. After seeing some progress in the past 2 years, last week the American Medical Association warned of increases in opioid-related overdoses during the pandemic. Well, my guest today was on the front lines in uncovering the role pharmaceutical companies and distributors played in this crisis. Eric Ayer was a longtime reporter for the Charleston Gazette Mail in West Virginia when he began working on a story about one small pharmacy down in coal country in the town of Kermit, West Virginia, that distributed 12 million opioid pills over a three-year period to a town with roughly 350 residents. Ayer tells the story of a woman who decided to investigate why her brother died of an overdose, which led to the doctor who prescribed the pills, that led to the pharmacy that filled it and others at a rate of one prescription a minute, as well as the pharmaceutical distributors who were ignoring every regulation on the book as far as opioid distribution, and the state and federal regulators who seemed more on the side of industry rather than the people they were supposed to protect. It's all part of his new book, Death in Mudlick, A Coal Country Fight Against the Drug Companies That Delivered the Opioid Epidemic. It's published by Scribner's. Eric Ayer's reporting won him a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting, and it forms the basis of his book. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Eric Ayer, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me on.
Your book, Death in Mudlick, documents a multi-year investigation into what was a pill dumping by large pharmaceutical companies to West Virginia in the rural areas, especially in the coal fields. Your story begins with the death of Bull Priest. Tell us a little bit about Bull Priest and how this sort of spurred your investigation.
Sure. Bull Priest was a bogeyman in a coal mine. He'd worked for most of his life in the coal mines. This is in the southern part of the state in the West Virginia coal fields. And he died of an OxyContin overdose back in 2005. His sister, Debbie Priest, didn't want his life to become just another, she said, I don't want him to be another statistic. And the statistics were already pretty scary. Back in 2005, I think we had upwards of 800 people a year dying of opioid drug overdoses in the state. And so she set out from that day forward that she wasn't going to let his life, be in vain, and she was going to try to hold people accountable for his death. So she found a lawyer, and she filed a wrongful death suit against the doctor that prescribed the OxyContin and the pharmacist who dispensed the drugs. It was a pharmacy that became kind of infamous because it was the one that had nearly 9 million prescription opioids dispensed over a two-year period back in 2007 and 2008.
9 million prescriptions?
Yeah, that was hydrocodone and oxycodone alone, two of the strongest painkillers that we have. It was quite a sight. I've looked at the surveillance videos, and you've got just cars lined up four or five deep through the drive-through. You've got people loitering in the parking lot selling drugs. It got so crowded at one point, and there were people coming from not just, Pennsylvania and Ohio and Kentucky and border states, but they were coming as far away as North Carolina and also from Florida. People were coming in to get their prescriptions filled. So to get the prescriptions filled, they'd have to drive by, well, from Florida, you'd probably drive by 100 pharmacies, but even in other states, you were driving, just 10 pharmacies you'd be passing just to get your prescription filled at the Save Right Pharmacy, it was called. And so it got so crowded. There's stuff in the subpoenas and everything about when they finally did a raid, that they couldn't get the cash drawers closed, that they were throwing drugs over the counter. And at one point, the owner of the pharmacy, customers were getting dissatisfied with wait time, so he set up a camper trailer type thing on the property, and they started selling hot dogs and hamburgers and Cokes, and in the inside you could get hot buttered popcorn to sort of appease the customers who were getting frustrated with the long wait times.
Now,
but they were doing one. I think it was one prescription a minute at one point.
Right. How large is this town where the Save Right?
Yeah, and that's the thing. It was only 382 people.
So 382 people?
Right.
9 million prescriptions. And this never...
Just opioids, right. I mean, they had other... They dispensed blood pressure medications and stuff, too. But yeah.
So the so from Bull Priest, it goes to a doctor named Donald Kaiser. He was prescribing multiple prescriptions.
Yeah, he eventually got busted for trading prescriptions for sex. But, yeah, he got shut down in West Virginia, arrested in West Virginia, and went up setting up a sham clinic up in Marietta, Ohio, which was more than 2 hours away. And then they set a system up where you could take, they had a van that would take people from southern West Virginia up to Ohio to get prescriptions from him. And then they turned back, the deal was, and they turned back and come back to Save Right Pharmacy and get the prescriptions filled. And they would pay the driver of the van in, you know, opioid drugs.
And the reason he had moved from West Virginia to Ohio was, again, suspicious in the first place, right?
Yeah, it was he was busted for trading prescriptions for sex, and he eventually did serve jail time. Debbie Priest, the woman that I mentioned, who was the sister of Bull Priest, she actually had a lot of trust in him because she knew him when he was an emergency physician at the local hospital. And she actually, after her brother died at one point, he realized he didn't have any proof that he had, you know, done any kind of examination or anything. So he wanted to put a X-ray in the file that he at least had done something. And she actually helped him to do that. But then she realized what she had done was part of a cover-up, and she called the authorities, and he wound up going to jail.
Now, this part of West Virginia, it's, as you write in the book, it said this is the area where the Hatfields and the McCoys feuded. It's coal country. It's a very depressed area. And it's also a place with a history of, I guess, lax law enforcement.
Yeah, there's a long history of corruption there. There's been multiple county officials, judges, people going to jail there on corruption charges, all sorts of political shenanigans going on. It's sort of the epicenter of our corruption in our state.
But out of this death of Bull Priest, it leads to the doctor, it leads to the pharmacy, and then that's where Priest and her attorney, Jim Cagle, step in to prosecute a case against the pharmacist, Jim Woolley. And that was really interesting because all of a sudden it comes to light that even in depositions, he goes, so you're prescribing about one prescription a minute? And Woolley says with pride, yes, I do.
Yeah, he took that with pride. And they try to get to the bottom of it. And, you know, why are you having so many people there? And initially he said it was because low prices and better service. I don't know if that was on his ad outside, but he was pressed further at one point, and you know, by some of the townspeople, and he said that it was tourists that were coming into the Hatfield. They have a Hatfield and McCoy trail system that has ATV riding on it, and he was trying to blame it on tourism. But the, you know, of course, the real tourist quote unquote spot was the Save Right Pharmacy, and people were coming there not necessarily for, you know, riding their four-wheelers.
Yeah. In fact, he was prescribing an enormous amount of opioids at a time when more and more people were dying from ODs, from oxycodone and hydrocodone. And, you know, about 1,700 people from 2007 to 2012 died. And at the same time, what eventually comes out in your book is that the large pharmaceutical companies were just dumping huge amount of pills in West Virginia with no oversight, no DEA examining the records, or if they were, they were just not looking at it, no oversight from state authorities or local authorities.
Yeah, what had happened was Debbie and Jim Cagle took it upon themselves to say, you know, hey, where are all these, you know, opioids coming from? Who's bringing them? And you can see in the videos, there's, you know, these delivery trucks that just showing up, and you know, the driver gets out and dollies are being wheeled into these pharmacies. She wound up actually following one of the delivery trucks in southern West Virginia. And she had the license plate traced, and it came back to a company called Cardinal Health, which turns out to be the largest distributor of prescription opioids in West Virginia. These are companies, Rich, that, just to explain to your listeners, they're called distributors or wholesale distributors, and they take the drugs from the factory, let's say from the Purdue Pharma factory or the generic drug factory, to a warehouse, and from that warehouse then they ship them to pharmacies and hospitals. They truck them to pharmacies and hospitals. And these are some of the biggest companies in the United States, according to the Fortune 500. We had one of the companies that delivered to the SaveRite was named McKesson, and that was at the time the sixth largest company in the United States. You had Cardinal Health, you had AmerisourceBergen, you had a regional distributor named Miami Lucan that were just dumping, you know, millions and millions of pills into these, not just Kermit, but some of these other small towns. Williamson, the county seat, had 23 million over a couple of years of prescription opioids pills dumped there, and it's a town of just 3,000 people. And there was another town called Mount Gay, so they were scattered all over. And we found, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but we found that this wasn't necessarily just the case in West Virginia. It would come out later that this was the case in small towns across America.
My guest today is Eric Ayer. He's, until recently, just a reporter at the Charleston Gazette-Mail. His coverage of the massive shipments of opioids to West Virginia's coal country would get him a Pulitzer Prize, and his book details that same reportage, Death in Mudlick, a coal country fight against the drug companies that delivered the opioid epidemic. It's published by Scribner. Well, out of that, those depositions and the lawsuits against SaveRite Pharmacy and pharmacist Jim Woolley, it led directly to Cardinal Health. And this is where you get the political influence going on, because these big distributors are political players in many states, but certainly in West Virginia.
Yeah, I had never heard of these companies before I got involved in this, and I got involved in kind of an unusual way. I was a state house reporter working down at the legislature, and I covered, you know, bills and committees and legislation moving and state government corruption and all that. And one of the assignments I had was to cover the governor's office, the agriculture commissioner, the treasurer, and also the attorney general. And we had a change of attorney generals. We had a Democrat who lost to a Republican outsider who nobody had heard of by the name of Patrick Morrissey. And once he got in office, Cagle's lawsuit actually got picked up by the state attorney general. The Democratic attorney general in 2012 files a lawsuit against all these distributors, Cardinal Health and AmerisourceBergen, McKesson, or not McKesson at the time, but a bunch of others. And then the new attorney general inherits those cases. Well, I got calls about 5 or 6 months into his term that he had this inaugural party, and it was very strange that an attorney general would have an inaugural party. The governor always had one, of course, but not the attorney general. So I did some digging. I got some documents, and it showed that one of the big contributors to his inaugural party was Cardinal Health. So he was overseeing this lawsuit against Cardinal Health that he inherited from his predecessor. And then we, you know, got some more information, and his wife, it turns out, was the lead lobbyist in Washington, D.C. for Cardinal Health, and also Cardinal Health executives that had helped bankroll his campaign. So the criticism was that, first off, he shouldn't be taking part in that lawsuit, and number two, the rumors we heard is that he was trying to negotiate a really good settlement for the company, not for the citizens of the state. So that was how I got involved in it.
Where was the oversight of these distributors? Is that held by the DEA, or is it held by state authorities?
Both. The Board of Pharmacy had rules on their books that they were supposed to require, and this is something that also the DEA does too, require these companies to report suspicious orders. And those were, you know, these gigantic orders of, you know, over several days or weeks that you know, these large numbers. And the Board of Pharmacy didn't enforce those rules. They admitted that they never enforced those rules. At one point after the suit was filed, the companies did start submitting their suspicious orders, but I went down to the pharmacy and asked to see them, and they brought out a box, and there were more than 7,000, I had to count them by hand, And I said, what did you do with all these, you know, these reports, these red flags? And they said, well, we didn't do anything with them. We just shelved them, and we didn't have the manpower to look through all these documents. And, you know, that was just an excuse, and they certainly could have done something with those reports. But they were just sitting just unchecked. They had a system where they inspected pharmacies, but they would just look for cleanliness and whether the drugs were kept in properly stored. And all the reports that we had, even the ones about Save-Rite, said clean, well-run facility, A+.
Wow.
But, you know, when I thought about that further, the Board of Pharmacy in our state is made up of pharmacists. And so they were sort of protecting their own. None of the board members were involved in this dispensing of these huge amount of opioids, but certainly they didn't want to hurt the business of their colleagues.
It seems like there's a built-in conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Now, who was in charge of filing these suspicious orders? Was it the distributors themselves, or was it...
Yeah, the distributors themselves.
So there's a conflict of interest there, because they're making enormous profits.
Yeah, and the DEA, to give the other side of it, you mentioned the DEA, and they weren't doing anything with them either. It came out during testimony that everything was being reported on paper, and there was no real-time reporting, and nobody was looking at the suspicious orders. Nobody was looking at, they have this electronic system called ARCOS data that, you know, that tracks every single pill purchase in the country. And they weren't even, you know, looking at those reports, despite the fact that distributors had set some of their own thresholds for distribution, and those numbers were being exceeded by 30, 40 times.
Now, while this investigation is going on, are the pills still being shipped to West Virginia during this time, or were controls being put in place on these just huge number of prescriptions being written in West Virginia?
No, the controls weren't put in place until about a year or two ago.
A year or two ago.
Yeah, they were unfettered. The shipments were just totally unfettered. And, you know, the DEA also admitted that there was a total lack of manpower here on the ground. They had two diversion investigators, drug diversion, and that means, you know, prescription drugs getting in the hands of criminals and, you know, on the street. And they had two for the entire state. We're a small state population-wise, but, you know, fairly large state geographically. One of the DEA investigators committed suicide, so at one point they only had one for the entire state. The local authorities, now state police did some good things. They were about the only ones that were on the ball. But, you know, people say, well, what about the local sheriff, and what about the local cops, and, you know, why weren't they doing anything? And that was primarily because the pharmacists had a lot of influence in town. The pharmacies would sponsor the local Little League teams. They would contribute to the mayor's race. And you know, in a town of Kermit, you know, $100 would go a long way.
Right.
A few voters. So, and then the other thing was, in a lot of cases, these were some of the best paying jobs in town. So if you worked at a pharmacy, and some of the wives of the sheriff's deputies worked at Save-Rite. So there was just conflicts everywhere.
I would think in a town of, say, 300 people, you have a pharmacy that's prescribing one prescription for opioids a minute. That's bringing in tremendous money. It's probably the basis of the tax system for the local community. It's the best jobs. It's providing, as you mentioned, off-duty jobs for the sheriff's deputies. It's just... nobody locally is going to touch it because it's the best economic activity in the town, probably.
Yeah, now that is definitely true. The case of Save-Rite, though, they were the largest contributor to the B&O tax, the business and occupational tax that cities rely on. But it turns out that they weren't paying what they should have been paying, because I think at one point they said they was making like $6 million a year, and the mayor turned, you know, showed me the ledger and said, you know, he's paying, you know, $100 a month or something like that.
Wow.
But you know, at the time, I guess they didn't want to say anything, because that was their largest B&O tax provider, because there's really no other. I mean, there's a, you know, a Dairy Queen and a couple little restaurants, and But that was the main business driver in town, was dispensing opioids.
My guest today is Eric Ayer. He's until just recently, he just retired from the Charleston Gazette Mail. His coverage of the massive shipments of opioids to rural West Virginia, for that coverage, he was awarded a Pulitzer Prize. And he's now written a book called Death in Mudlick, A Cold Country Fight Against the Drug Companies That Delivered the Opioid Epidemic. It's published by Scribner, and it details his reporting over a number of years on this rural southern West Virginia community and the whole delivery of opioids in the state, in cold country. And the total number of pills sent to West Virginia was just this astonishing total, 780 million pills sent to West Virginia over a six-year period. That's 433 pills for every man, woman, and child in the state. And for several years, it just went on with no oversight whatsoever. And then once oversight began to take a look at this, there was this immense pushback from these drug distributors like AmerisourceBergen, McKesson, and Cardinal Health against providing the records and giving us a sense of the depth of the problem in West Virginia.
Yeah, we had to go to court and intervene in the state case, the state attorney general's case. They decided to, at one point, file things under seal. And in terms of, it was an updated complaint in the lawsuit that had new allegations in it about distribution, and they were keeping them under wraps. And, you know, I talked to a lawyer. We have a pro bono lawyer at West Virginia University, and he said, you know, this is a lawsuit filed on the behalf of the citizens of West Virginia. You can't keep that, you know, you can't seal that up. So we went to court. It was quite a battle. We showed up in the courtroom, and it was the first time I realized how big these companies were and how the deck was stacked against us, because there were, you know, all these lawyers were there, and they're talking about they're flying in, and I'm like, you know, we're down in this little country courthouse in Boone County, West Virginia, real small county in the heart of coal country, and, you know, they're there. I got to catch my flight back to New York or Washington, D.C., so they brought in, like, you know, all this corporate counsel and these white-shoe lawyers from D.C. and Columbus and Pittsburgh, and so we went to court. They fought us tooth and nail to keep these pill numbers under wraps, and we actually were fortunate enough. I guess our ace in the hole, we hired a local attorney that had a good rapport with the judge, and we were able to get those unsealed. And from there, for the first time, we saw the numbers, you know, distributors sending, you know, 30,000 OxyContin to a pharmacy one day, and then 3 days later, sending another 50,000 OxyContin pills, and sending more in a week than they should have sent in a year. And then from there, we went and got the lawsuits mentioned that this information was from the Drug Enforcement Administration. The DEA had this data, the Arcos data that I mentioned earlier. And from there, that we got spreadsheets that showed every pill to every county, to every pharmacy in the state over that six-year period. That's what showed the 780 million just hydrocodone and OxyContin over that short period. And that's what really broke the story wide open.
And what I found was how sort of a whole coalition of forces were fighting against getting this information out there from the DEA itself. It didn't want this information out there. It was pleading, I guess, bureaucratic incompetence as far as getting the numbers out there. State officials didn't want those out there. They were trying to quash public release of this. And it just required dogged determination on the part of your attorneys, as well as the paper itself, to continue in this litigation at a time when it was struggling.
Well, we sure was struggling. We went bankrupt, but that was struggling. Yeah, so we got this idea. Oklahoma and towns across the country, states and towns all got together, and there was more than 2,500 lawsuits filed against these distributors as well as the manufacturers. And as part of that, the plaintiff's attorneys, the ones that filed the suits, were given these numbers. So we said, well, if they've got the numbers and they're representing states like Oklahoma, and then, you know, by golly, everybody, we should be able to see these numbers for every state and city in the country. And then the DEA teams up with the distributors and says, no, you can't see them. There's a protective order. If you release these numbers, we're going to have criminals that are going to use the numbers to plan robberies of pharmacies and all kinds of other nonsense. And they teamed up and they fought us, the DEA and the distributors. We went to the court and, we lost at the first at the federal district level with the judge, but then we went to do the appeal, and the DEA attorneys are showing up, sitting on the same side of the room with the attorneys for the drug distributors. And, you know, maybe the drug distributors said it was putting them in a competitive business disadvantage. That was their argument. The DEA had the criminals are going to use this information to plan robberies of pharmacies. But at the end of the day, the appeals court didn't buy those arguments, so they released it. And then from there, the Washington Post, actually, who had teamed up with us in the legal battle, was the first one to post the national numbers, which turned out to be, you know, more than 100 billion just hydrocodone and oxycodone alone distributed over, and it turned out to be an 8-year period that we looked at. You know, at every step, we were stonewalled by the drug companies and the DEA and regulators. But at the end of the day, the information did get out, which was picked up across the country by papers, and they found all sorts of other examples. I don't think anything as glaring as Kermit, but there were plenty of towns. I can guarantee you there were plenty of towns in Oklahoma that had similar, widely disproportionate number of pills for the amount of people that were in the town.
Do you think there is now proper oversight of this industry, or is it still an open question?
I think now there has been such a spotlight on it. They seem to be behaving properly at this point. I think it would be really a bad look if they would return. There's been a number of legislative actions across the country in terms of limiting these prescriptions. You can't get, you know, like Bull Priest, he had like 540 prescription opioids over the course of like 5 weeks prescribed to him. You can't do that anymore. There's limits. There's 7-day limits of how many opioids you can prescribe. There was a congressional investigation which set in place new laws for reporting, real-time reporting. So I don't think it's anywhere near as what it was before. And the concern now is that these drug companies are trying to reshape their image in COVID-19. Their CEOs have shown up at press conferences with Kushner and Trump saying, you know, we're vital to the healthcare system because they also distribute medical equipment, you know, the PPE and the masks, and that they're making the case that they're essential for handling the pandemic we're going through right now.
Well, it's some really amazing reporting that you relate in the book, Death in Mudlick. Eric Ayer, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on, Rich. Really appreciate it.
Pulitzer Prize winning reporter Eric Ayer is my guest today. He is the author of Death in Mudlick, a Coal Country Fight Against the Drug Companies That Delivered the Opioid Epidemic. It's published by Scribner. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.